The name of David is well known from the Bible, with a lot of adjectives and attributes connected. David was the second king of Israel, the book says, and also a poet and a musician, a warrior and a peacemaker, a paragon of virtue, and an adulterer. Someone that interesting and complicated should probably get his own book. We don't know how many might have come before, but there is a new one out now called David, The Divided Heart. It is the work of David Wolpe. He's a rabbi currently at the Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. His writing, seven books before now and speaking, have added to his reputation as the most influential rabbi in America, so named by Newsweek 2 years ago. David Wolpe is no stranger to appearances on radio and television, and we certainly thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a very big subject matter, but a surprisingly compact book. What got all this started, David?
Well, it's part of a series that Yale University Press put out called Jewish Lives. And the idea was to make short, accessible biographies of big, complicated figures. And David is certainly that, as you said eloquently in your introduction. There are so many facets to his life that it's hard to capture them all in a streamlined fashion, but I tried.
Entangled with war, women, and offspring is one of your quotes in the book. So, yeah, this really does sound like a complicated life.
Well, part of it is you have to think about David the way you think about a modern political figure, which is all the complicated issues that they have to deal with. But at the same time, he's got theological baggage, and also he has an artistic soul, and also a little bit of a larcenist in him, that is. So he's a very large figure. He embraces a lot, and I think that we're not used to thinking of our political figures that way. There was a time, you know, when you had people like Churchill, who also won Nobel Prizes for literature, and others who were musicians or poets, but that doesn't seem to be the fashion these days. But David was certainly all those things.
Well, I'm glad you put that in the perspective, in the context of modern political figures, because it does help to remember sometimes that people who we expect great things from also can do some fairly awful things, too, because some of the same character traits that lead them to believe they are in a position to lead also lead them to believe that they can get away with a lot of things.
There's no question that there's a certain, I mean, I don't want to throw around psychological terms too loosely. I'm not a psychologist.
Okay.
But let's use narcissism for a second. People who have very high self-regard are people who think they can lead. Otherwise, they wouldn't be leaders. And then it gets reinforced by other people telling them how wonderful they are, and by their successes, and by their view of native ability. I mean, David comes along, for example, and Saul is the king. And in very short order, it says in the Bible that the women in the streets are saying, Saul killed thousands, but David killed tens of thousands, which may not be a literal comment. He may not have killed tens of thousands, but what they're saying basically is Saul's okay, but David is great. Well, you hear that long enough, and it's hard not to believe it.
Now, David Wolpe, you have been known to challenge the historical accuracy of certain Bible stories. Were there texts available other than the Bible to help flesh out David, who's pretty remote to us in time?
Well, that's true, and it's the answer is sort of yes, but sort of no. By that I mean, up to about 20, 25 years ago, people debated whether David actually existed. Then they found a couple of things, one in particular, which was a stone inscription that said, from the house of David, and it was written by a non-Jewish king. So we're pretty sure, and that was about 200 years after David was supposed to have lived, so 200 years later, you wouldn't have an enemy writing about the house of David if there was no David. So that more or less settled whether there was a David. The question of whether he did what the Bible says he did, that's a tougher question, and I think the best evidence for it, you can't prove it one way or the other, but the best evidence for it is a lot of the book of David is about how he wasn't as bad in some ways as you might think. That is, you might think he did this, but really, when this enemy of his was killed, he wasn't even there. Now, that's a very strange thing to write if you're making up a figure. It makes a lot more sense if people thought bad things about David, and the writer was trying to say, no, you're actually wrong. But you don't defend someone who is an invented character and never did anything bad in the first place. So I think the evidence is pretty strong that there was a David and that he was controversial.
Are the stories of David in the Bible then, I mean, the way you describe it, it sounds like it's a bit of an effort at character rehabilitation, sort of like people writing nice biographies of Nixon years later or something.
I think
not quite to that extent.
Exactly. I think in some ways it is, and that lets you know how complicated David really was. There are several modern novels about David, but there's one that's really outstanding by a guy who lived in East Germany for many years when it was a communist state, and it's called The King David Report. And you get a sense of how hard it is. I mean, he's writing it about King David, but obviously he's writing it about East Germany. And you get a sense of how hard it is to be honest about kings in a small kingdom, which is what Israel was, with competing factions. And I think the Bible is both honest in its account, because it clearly says when David does the most terrible things, but also wants to let you know that this was an extraordinary man and a great leader.
All right, so we are reasonably certain that he existed. Is it still possible that David could be a composite, that it's more than one person getting credit for, or one person getting credit for the works of more than one person?
It's certainly, for example, the Psalms. It's certainly possible that David wrote some of the Psalms, although there's a lot of evidence that many of them were written later. So, yes, he could have gotten a bigger portfolio historically than he actually had in his lifetime, and maybe some of the virtues that they attribute to David were later added on, but I think he had plenty of his own as well.
Fascinating character and a very interesting book about him, David, The Divided Heart, written by Rabbi David Wolpe. David Wolpe is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Oh, to get the other David on the exchange. Not possible. We'll come back and talk with this David about that David when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest on this New Year's Eve is David Wolpe, rabbi from the Sinai Temple in Los Angeles, author many times over, public speaker, television and radio commentator, and our guest because he's written a book called David, The Divided Heart. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about King David from the Bible and many facets of his existence, and he is a many-faceted character. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. David Wolpe, I wonder how much you had a chance to assess what people think they know about King David in this day and age. I must admit, not being a terribly religious person myself, I always come back to Linus from the Peanuts Christmas special saying the City of David, because that's what Bethlehem is called.
Right. So my sense, and one of the reasons that I chose to write about David, not the principal one, but one of them, is that most people really know much less about David than they know about other major biblical characters, and much less about David than his historical importance would warrant. So they have a vague idea. I mean, everyone knows David and Goliath. That one is more or less widespread. But they know David did something bad with Bathsheba, and they have some sense that he was the founder of Jerusalem, but that's about as far as it goes for most people, I think, unless, they've recently read the Book of Samuel, which is where the story of David is located.
And we already have a question from Jeannie in Medford wondering why the Star of David is named so.
Well, that's a great question, and it's actually later. It's medieval. It doesn't go back all the way to David, even though you might think it does. And in fact, the book was the biography I wrote was optioned by Warner Brothers, and they're planning on making it into a movie. I don't know whether it'll ever happen or not, but they're planning on it. So the guy who's writing the script asked me if he could use the Star of David. And I said, I wish you could, but the truth is, in David's time, no one had seen the Star of David. It became associated with Israel later.
but just named for David because he was such
a
pivotal figure.
Because he was such an iconic figure, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You do say, though, that David is the Bible's great slanted story. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I was quoting Emily Dickinson, who said, tell the truth, but tell it slant. In other words, not full on, by hints and stories. And that's really more than the Bible tells you David was like this. It gives you various stories about David, and you have to put together who is this guy who could commit adultery, kill the woman's husband so that he wouldn't get found out, which is what David does, and yet at the same time, when he's discovered by a prophet, rather than kill the prophet or keep the prophet quiet or deny it, break down, cry, repent, ask God's forgiveness, he's a very complicated figure, and you have to put all these stories together to figure out that someone could have a very close relationship to God and yet at the same time be, in terms of earthly calculation, so brutal and at times warlike.
Help us get a fix in time. When approximately did David live? I mean, how long after Moses, for example?
Okay, so here's an easy timeline to think about it. Around 1300 BCE are generally the dates given for Moses. About 1000 BCE, that's before the Common Era, or before the time of Jesus, is the time of David. That's 1000. So it's about 1000 years before Roman times and the time of Jesus and the time of the Talmudic rabbis.
So just a couple of hundred years after Moses, really.
Yes, just a few hundred years after. Remember, Moses comes in to Israel is established, and then there's the time of Joshua, the judges, and shortly after the judges comes Samuel, who is a high priest and leader, and Samuel gives way to the first king, who is Saul, and the second king is David. It's really 300, I mean, it depends whose calculations you accept, but it's only a few hundred years after.
David Wolpe, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of David, The Divided Heart. And the first mention of David, then he's only mentioned in Samuel 1, Samuel 2?
Well, he's mentioned elsewhere in the Bible. And in fact, his story is told again in Chronicles, but Chronicles is much more apologetic. That is, it really cleans up the David story. So it seems like Samuel is the more reliable source and certainly the more vivid story.
So what, if anything, would have indicated kingship in future for David as a younger man?
Well, what happens is that Samuel is told to go to the house of Jesse the Bethlehemite, and there he'll find a new king. And he goes, and he sees all seven of his children, and none of them is the new king. And finally, Samuel says to Jesse, don't you have any more kids? And he goes, well, there's the little one out back. And he says, bring him in. And he comes in, and the Bible says he's young and ruddy-cheeked, and God says to Samuel, rise and anoint him. This is the one. So according to the Bible's account, it was God telling Samuel, this neglected child, this little kid who nobody's paying attention to, this kid whose own father doesn't even bother to introduce him to the company, he's the one who's going to be the new king of Israel. And that theme, which is, of course, a theme throughout the Bible, that the younger child, the more neglected, the smaller, the overlooked, is the one that will eventually triumph, is very powerfully present in the story of David.
You can see where underdog stories continue to take hold in the human consciousness. We've had them for a very long time.
It's true, and it's always a delight. I mean, even in children's books you see this. You know, it's always the one that you don't expect to succeed who in the end does, and David does it not only by native ability, but also by human sympathy, because the early stories of David, there are three stories that introduce him. One is going to the house of Samuel going to the house of Jesse. One is the story of David and Goliath. And the third is the story of David going to Saul, who is the king of Israel, who has these deeply depressive episodes, and playing music and bringing him out of his lethargy and his sadness.
You say a character's first words in the Bible are defining, and so in David's case, what are those words?
This does tell you something about him. David comes to where Israelites and the Philistines are fighting, and Saul is trying to find someone to take on Goliath, but he can't find anyone to do it. And so he's offering rewards. And David's older brothers, who are warriors, are there. And David comes along because his father tells him to bring food to his older brothers. And the first words out of his mouth, the first thing we hear David say is, "What will be given to the man who defeats Goliath?" Then he goes on to say, because he's insulted the God of Israel and so on and so forth, but the first words out of his mouth are, "What do I get out of this?" And so you already, if you're attuned to the biblical rhythms, you already say, this is not a conventional hero. This is an interesting character.
What's in it for me?
Yes.
So he defies convention, but as you point out, even physics. Give us some examples of that.
Yes, well, right. He hits Goliath with a stone, and Goliath falls forward instead of backward, which is not what's supposed to happen. And part of this is, and by the way, for those of you who will see the wonderful movie Into the Woods, which I just saw, there's a repetition of that scene, which I won't give away, but there's a sort of repetition of that scene.
Oh, that's right. There are giants in Into the Woods.
Yes, exactly. There are giants in Into the Woods. But the thing is, but what makes David exceptional is everybody, at first glance, misreads the David-Goliath story because it seems like Goliath has the advantage. But the truth is, David has a long-range weapon. I mean, Goliath has a sword, but David's got a slingshot. And if you're good enough with a slingshot, and by the way, modern researchers have done all sorts of work with Bedouins and slingshots, and shepherds have a lot of time to practice, if you're good enough with a slingshot, you really have an advantage because you can stand far away.
He essentially had a gun in a sword fight.
Yes, exactly. So David was, he was cunning and brilliant and saw possibilities where others, you know, anybody else could have done that too, but nobody thought of it.
David Wolpe again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, rabbi at the Sinai Temple in Los Angeles, author many times over. His latest book is a biography of David, as in King David. It is called David, the Divided Heart. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe there's some facets of the David story you'd like to plumb with us. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to take a little time out here for a language lesson, based on some previous conversations here on the Exchange. Are texts in Hebrew often open to several interpretations?
Yes, they are. They're open to several interpretations. And by the way, what many of your listeners may not know is that there is no single unvariable text. That is, when you look at old manuscripts or at early translations of the Bible into Greek, for example, there are sometimes differences from the text that we have today. So if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are sometimes differences. They're very minor, but there are differences. And just like in English, you can interpret sentences differently. And also, the first editions of Hebrew writing had no punctuation and no spaces between letters. That came later. So just imagine if you opened a book and it was one continuous word and you had to sort of make divisions between it, you would be guessing, it would be your best guess, but you could certainly make mistakes or choose one meaning over another. And so there are many, many sentences, some more in some books than other books, there are many sentences in the Hebrew Bible that are disputed. Let's put it that way.
It sounds like putting together a puzzle where if you change the meaning of one word, then the rest of the sentence
the others will change. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is part of what disputes have been between, for example, Jews and Christians over interpretations of the Hebrew Bible. Some of them have been thematic, but some of them have been linguistic. This word actually means this. No, this word actually means that. So the disputes have historical, theological, and sometimes just intellectual interest.
Let us take a call. We have Grumpy John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Wolpe, the author of David, the Divided Heart.
Thanks. I'm calling about an unfortunate term that's in use here. When we say, we in the U.S. say slingshot, we think of a forked stick with some elastic bands driving a stone. This is not what we're talking about when we're talking about a sling,
mm-hmm.
which
right.
is a pouch attached to two strings, so you can get a fair-sized rock whirling at a good speed before you release one of the ends of that sling and propel a really large projectile, heavy, at a rapid rate. We have no idea what slingshot means in biblical terms. So I wish we could find a better word, maybe just sling rather than slingshot. Because
that's a fabulous comment. It's exactly right, and it makes me wish now that I had gone back and made that clearer when I told the David Goliath story, because that's true. What shepherds would do in ancient Israel is they would have a sling or whatever you want, a pouch, basically, and each day they would have different numbers of sheep. One day you would have 10, one day you would have 15. So they would keep the number of stones in the pouch that they had sheep so that they could keep a count, which means that that pouch has to be, as Grumpy John just said, has to be ample enough to hold a significant number of stones. So if you put one in it, it could be a large one. And as I said, you can get lots of practice slinging them, and you can do a lot of damage.
I have to wonder if the discovery of the usefulness of the slingshot for that purpose was accidental, if somebody was twirling it around like a lifeguard twirls a whistle, and the stone came out and blam, ow!
I think that that's entirely possible, since some of our best discoveries, I'm sure, were inadvertent.
All right, ballistics discussion aside, back to the story of David. You already mentioned David's meeting, David of the Future King meeting Saul the incumbent, and it's when Saul was depressed and David went to play music for him?
Mm-hmm. And what happens, and here's where you can see David two different ways. So what happens in Saul's house is eventually Saul's daughter, Michal, falls in love with David, and Saul's son, Jonathan, becomes David's close friend, some say lover, whatever the situation is. The point is that you either see David as someone who goes in there and in a Machiavellian, calculated way, gets Saul's kids to love him so that he can be the new king, since after all, Saul's son would normally be the new king. Or you see David as just so charismatic and wonderful that he's naturally beloved. And that's, by the way, what the name David means. It means beloved. So as you go through the story, you can see David as either calculating or just extravagantly gifted and loved. And the Bible never tells you from story to story exactly which way you have to see him.
The Bible, I suppose, is not terribly big on why, given that it's generally a book about a deity and the workings thereof.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really have to explain why, but is there any indication of what it is that God sees in David that makes him not only the guy who should be king, but as potentially the forebearer for a Messiah?
Well, you're absolutely right. And one of the things... I have a theory about this. That's actually the theory that closes the book. But before I tell you the theory, what you said is very true, and what makes the David story different is that it doesn't feel nearly as stilted or formalized or mythological as the stories of Abraham, for example. It feels very human and very historical. And when you ask yourself why God would care about David... If the Messiah is supposed to be the sum total of human experience, I mean, everything we are in all its facets, then it makes sense that you would pick the person who was everything. And David is as close to a total human being as someone could be in that age. As you said, he's a warrior, he's a lover, he's a poet, he's a sinner, he's a creator of prayers, and... He is a father and a son and a sibling, and I mean, that short list doesn't begin to exhaust the facets of this character. And so if God wants to pick someone who is sort of the summit of human possibility, David's your man.
Well, and a difference, too, from the stories of Abraham and Moses, for example, is David does not have a regular conversation directly with God, does he?
No, David doesn't speak to God the way Moses and Abraham do. David does it through... sort of divining stones called Urim v'Tumim, where you ask yes or no questions, or David speaks to God. God does give promises to David in the book of Samuel, but they're not conversations the way you have conversations in Genesis, for example. And one of the fascinating things about the Hebrew Bible that your listeners can trace is from the book of Genesis to the very end, God gradually recedes. God sort of disappears in a way. It's almost as almost like you do with a child. That is, you know, at the beginning of a child's life, you're constantly there. You interfere with everything. You feed them. You take care of them. And then when they walk, at first you hold their hand, then you move a little bit away and then further away. And that same sense of parental distance to allow the child to walk on her or his own, that's what you get gradually as the Hebrew Bible goes along.
So he begins as controller and becomes more like a consultant as time goes on.
Exactly. There you go. That's a perfect biography of God, from controller to consultant. I like your title.
David Wolpe is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is David, the Divided Heart. It is about the many facets of David. David the Goliath Slayer, David the King, David the Adulterer, David the Warrior. All these brought up in what's a reasonably compact book in the Jewish Lives series from Yale University Press. We'll come back and talk more with David Wolpe, and you can call us as well. You can join the discussion by phone or by email. We'll give you the phone number and email address again when we return from this break. David Wolpe and you back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. For that matter, the final segment of the Exchange for 2014. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking to Rabbi David Wolpe, the author of many books, a well-known speaker, called by Newsweek the most influential rabbi in America 2 years ago. He's the author of a new book about David. David, the Divided Heart is the title of the book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the many facets of the biblical King David. 800-838-3760 around the region. 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So no big surprise when you have a guy who is destined to be king and there's still a living incumbent king, he's going to get on that guy's bad side. So how ultimately did David get on Saul's bad side?
Yeah, well, that's true. He got on his bad side, first of all, because people started to talk about David as though he was the king that would be. And so Saul obviously felt both jealous and also because it fed into Saul's paranoia to start with, there was, beyond jealousy, a rage towards David, and Saul begins to try to take David's life, and he does that multiple times unsuccessfully. Saul marries him to his daughter, not only because his daughter loves David, but because Saul figures that will be a way of ensnaring him, and he actually asks him for a bride price of 200 Philistine foreskins. Here, Joseph Heller, who wrote a book called God Knows, which is a novel about David, makes a comment. He says that, you know, it was at this point that David realized that foreskins were more easily taken from dead Philistines. And David comes back with, instead of 100, he brings back 200 foreskins, which is, again, a way of saying, I'm gifted far beyond anything you can imagine, and I can do what I want. And so it makes Saul that much angrier. And the first half of the David story, essentially, is Saul's pursuit of him all across Israel, where he tries to kill him. And David evades him. And in fact, once or twice, David has Saul in his own sights and could kill the man who's pursuing him, but doesn't. First, because he has reverence, I suppose, for the king of Israel, and second, because assassinating your predecessor is not a really good way of coming into the kingship. Because,
as you point out, it sets up a precedent.
People start to get ideas. Right. But eventually, Saul is killed in battle, and then David is available to take the kingship.
All right, a couple of other people I want to mention here, though. Abigail, who is she, and why does she get what you point out as the longest prose speech of any woman in all of Scripture?
Yes, it is. And it's also, Abigail is the only woman in the Bible who is called intelligent before she's called beautiful. There's something exceptional about her. She prevents David from making a terrible mistake of killing her husband, which he wants to do in his fury. And she gives a long speech in which she persuades him not to do it. And he listens to her. And this is one of the exceptional facets of David's character, which you would not expect. And that is that he again and again listens very carefully to women and often changes his behavior based on what they say. This is not a characteristic that you associate with men in the Bible or perhaps with men in general.
So what in the world was David doing visiting the king of the Philistines with Goliath's sword in hand?
Well, why David visited the king of the Philistines is, again, one of those double-sided questions. Either he was being traitorous to Israel, or he was secretly trying to aid Israel while preserving his own life from Saul. Because remember, Saul was running all over the territory of Israel trying to kill him. So David had no place to hide. So he went off to Israel's enemies, to the Philistines, and pretended to be loyal to them. Whether he was really loyal or not is something that obviously was debated in ancient Israel, but the book of Samuel takes the view that he was never loyal to the king of the Philistines. And in fact, there is the first time he meets the king of the Philistines, he even feigns madness. Which feigning madness and not really being mad is one of the many, many themes in the Book of David that you can also find in Shakespeare.
Is there any character up to this point in the Bible, Old Testament, if you prefer, that who is as multifaceted as David is? I mean, is he like the most fully realized character that's come along in the Bible up to this point?
I think he's the most fully realized character in the Hebrew Bible in general. And in some ways, you could argue, in all of Scripture, because David, unlike, for example, Jesus, has a family. That is, he has children. He has siblings he has that he interacts with, that he has more than one wife. In that sense, David is a fully realized person. It's almost like a modern biography. In fact, one biblical historian, Baruch Halpern, calls it the first modern biography, the story of David. He lives I don't want to say a normal life. It's obviously not a normal life, but he lives a fully human life in all of its facets, and never shows any supernatural abilities or qualities. That is, David never does anything, never works any miracles, and no miracles are worked for him. It's a fully human story.
No parting of the Red Sea, nothing like that?
Nothing like that, exactly.
David Wolpe, again, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is David, the Divided Heart. The issue where David has the opportunity to kill Saul, and you've given a couple of reasons for that, I mean, part of that, I have to wonder if it's also a writing device, you know, or at least a one-step removed thing. I mean, you reference The Godfather yourself a couple times in the book, and I wonder if it's one of these deals where the boss doesn't do the killing himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly David's one of the most intriguing questions, which is a little bit too complicated to explain in detail right now, but one of the complicated questions is that David's enemies keep dying and David is never there. I mean, what happens, here's the pattern. Someone kills one of David's enemies. Then they come to David and say, I have killed your enemy so-and-so. And David, rather than saying, oh, that's great, says, how dare you kill this man? And has the people who executed him executed. That is, he kills the killers. And again, you can see this one of two ways. Either, wow, David is such a good guy that he doesn't want even his enemies assassinated for various reasons, or David now has succeeded not only in getting his enemies assassinated, but in killing the only people who can testify to the fact that he wanted them assassinated. So it's a tough one. You see it. It's almost like one of those gestalt test where you can see the cup from one side or the two faces, but you can't see both at the same time.
So obviously when David is on the outs with Saul and is seeking refuge pretty much any place he can get it, he does seek God's help.
Yes.
And how does he connect with God?
Well, David, in the most, I would say in some ways in the most moving part of the Bible is actually not even when he's fleeing from Saul, but the second half of David's story is he's fleeing from his son. The first half he flees from his surrogate father. The second half he flees from his son Absalom, who starts a rebellion to take the kingdom from him. And you see this once powerful king weeping, walking across the hills of Judea, fleeing from his own child who's taken the city of Jerusalem from him. And there he cries out to God. But again, what you have is that double-sided David. Yes, he cries out to God. He prays and he speaks beautifully and movingly. But at the same time, he sends his friend Hushai to be a spy in the camp of Absalom. And it's Hushai's bad advice to Absalom that eventually wins David back his kingdom. So he's one of those, you know, he's one of those people who follows the advice of pray to God, but keep your powder dry. That is, he doesn't neglect the earthly necessities at the same time as he prays.
I want to come back to Saul's death, though, because that does seem to give us an expression that lasts until this day.
Yes. So when Saul and Jonathan die in battle, which is at the end of the first book of Samuel, the beginning of the second, there is this quite immortal and beautiful elegy that David offers, which is particularly beautiful in Hebrew, Ech Naflu Giborim, how the mighty have fallen, but also in a traditional translation is very moving. Because you get a sense that, look, these were the defining people of his life, his greatest friend, and the man who was both his mentor and his tormentor, that is Saul. And so when David opens up into poetry, and one of the reasons why we believe David as psalmist is because of the beauty of this elegy, it rings throughout the ages, and those cadences are still spoken by people. And when you say how the mighty have fallen, you know, it's still chilling and powerful.
How the mighty have fallen, and also the act itself. I mean, essentially, Saul dies by falling on his sword.
Yes. There are actually two suicides in the book of Samuel, one a man named Achitophel and the other Saul. And Saul falls on his sword because he knows the Philistines are going to come and not only kill him, but probably disgrace his body, torment him. And so he asks his sword bearer to kill him, but the sword bearer won't do it. So he falls on his own sword, which is really a tragic end to a very tragic figure. Saul was summoned by God to do something that was beyond his capacity. And that's, you know, when you're called to a great historic task and you're not up to it, that's a tragedy.
So how did David then make a claim to the kingship of Israel? Remembering that Saul was the first king of Israel. How does David make the claim? How is it accepted? And how much consolidation of power activity does he have to go through?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there's some of it that we can tell and some of it that we can't tell. It's clear that David has, over time, built up a loyalty to him and that his success in battle matters, especially because the Philistines were a constant threat to Israel. So he has some structure in place, but when he comes back, Israel is still divided into a northern and a southern kingdom. And in the northern kingdom, Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, is ruling. So David doesn't come back as the king of an undivided Israel. He comes back as the king of the southern part of Israel, which is where he's from. And his establishment of Jerusalem was like the establishment of Washington, D.C. That is, it was intended to be midway between south and north so that he could rule the whole kingdom from there. But it isn't until 2 years later when Ish-bosheth is assassinated, one of those instances that I spoke of before, where David gets angry at the assassins mm-hmm. for doing him a favor. It isn't until then that David has undivided rule. And as we know from the Absalom rebellion, the undivided rule didn't last all that long. That is, you know, maybe in some ways, I think David's greatest accomplishment for a king in the ancient world or the medieval world, it's an astonishing accomplishment, is he dies in his bed.
Really, not in battle.
Yeah, instead of in battle. It's, I quote there, I think it was Louis the 14th who said that he wanted to be killed by his enemies and not by his children. Because usually it's your own family, since they're the ones that will inherit the kingship, as well as your enemies that pose the most potent threat. And David managed somehow not only to die in his bed, but to pass the kingdom on to his child Solomon.
We haven't talked about David as sinner. I mean, how does Bathsheba come to David's attention?
Well, that's an interesting way of phrasing the question. I don't know who provoked the attention for whom, but David is out walking on his roof and he spots Bathsheba bathing, and he summons her to the palace, and she's identified as the daughter of someone and the wife of someone. So it's clear that she's taken, but it is equally clear that David doesn't care. And so he brings her to the palace, he sleeps with her, and discovers that she's pregnant. And when she's pregnant, he decides that he'll just bring her husband home and have him sleep with her. But her husband, whose name is Uriah the Hittite, he's not even an Israelite. That is, he's one of the tribes who live in Israel territory and associate themselves with Israel. He's nobler than the Israelite king. He won't sleep with his wife while his comrades are out there fighting. And so he tells the king, I can't go home and sleep with my wife because, you know, your troops are out there and they're fighting a war. So David gets him drunk, which I guess he had assumed would certainly get him to go home and sleep with his wife. But even then, Uriah won't do it.
Wow. It's a very complicated character, again, as we've been saying since the very beginning, but a wonderful book to help us understand him better. David, The Divided Heart, written by Rabbi David Wolpe, who's been our guest today. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Good to have you.